We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls for this hour of the show. This week, the University of Illinois is hosting the Early Spring Literary Festival. This is the second year for the event. It's something that's sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English. And a number of people have come here to the campus to talk about writing and to talk about their work. And we're pleased to have here in the studio with us this morning one of the guests. His name is Adam Levin. He's a writer. He lives in Chicago. He's the author of the novel The Instructions, a book that was first published last fall and got a lot of attention, in part because of its heft, but not just because of that. It has gotten a lot of favorable mention, and we'll be talking a little bit about the book, something about the story that it tells, a little bit about the process of writing, and certainly we'd be happy to take whatever questions you might have. Adam's stories have appeared in a number of places, including The Ninth Letter, Tin House, McSweeney's, and Esquire. He holds a creative writing degree, MFA in creative writing from Syracuse University, also an MA in clinical social work from the University of Chicago. His collection of short stories, Hot Pink, will be published by McSweeney's this year. He makes his home in Chicago, where he teaches writing at Columbia College and the School of the Art Institute. Anybody here at any point here, if you want to be involved in the conversation, you can do that, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And also the possibility of email. You want to send in your thoughts that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
I appreciate it. The best way maybe to start out here is to for me to ask you to introduce Gurion Ben-Judah Maccabee, the 10-year-old boy who is the protagonist of the story.
Sure. He is, without giving too much away, he's a 10-year-old boy who lives in the city of Chicago, has been kicked out of multiple Jewish day schools for acts of violence, mostly. One act of violence and another for teaching his fellow students how to build a kind of weapon that's actually very easy to build and useful.
Which you have thoughtfully, yeah. There are thoughtfully provided a step-by-step instructions on the web now,
yes,
that you can see how to make one of these.
Yeah, we made these things as kids. They work. He's the son of a civil rights lawyer who his father is often defending anti-Semitic groups, even though he's Jewish. His mother is a behavioral psychologist, and she is Ethiopian Israeli. So he is the narrator is hybridized, as they say, mixed race. His fellow students and maybe a couple adults, but quite a lot of his fellow students believe he might be the Messiah. As in, like, you know, the Messiah of the Jews, the real
capital
deal.
Capital M Messiah.
Yeah. And very messy Messiah. And then there are those who don't believe that. The book starts out with him. He's already been kicked out of these schools, and now he is in a lockdown program at a public school in the suburbs. The program's called The Cage. It's an Aptekissick Junior High School.
You know? Yeah. So here's his character. He's a 10-year-old boy. He's someone who is obviously very smart and a tough kid as well. Mm-hmm. And so it has both those things going. Someone who is a known troublemaker, been tossed out of all these schools, sure. And then it ends up in this place for kids who are troublemakers.
Right.
And it seems like it's a kind of story, these stories about kids who were really smart but who also don't quite fit in, that go up against the established order, sometimes with their wit, sometimes with their fist, in this case, with both. Mm-hmm. Why do these kinds of stories have such appeal, do you think?
It depends which one you're talking about. I think that you know, a lot of times I have, because I tend, I actually tend to often dislike those stories. The wunderkind stories are often about sort of congratulating the reader, like for being smart, like the protagonist or something. And I think there's a falsity to that. But I think that I certainly used to like those. And I think that basically people, you know, and maybe it's just Americans, I don't know. I'm American, so that's all I know. But I think we sort of idealize youth pretty powerfully, and we want to think that we were very special. I think we were told, at least my generation was certainly often told, we were very special. And so we read these novels where you have a very special protagonist who's a little kid, and you identify with him. And I don't know. It has something to do with that. But yeah.
So I read that you when you started writing this when you were at Syracuse.
Yes.
And that maybe in part at the beginning the character was inspired by someone that you actually did know when you were in junior high.
Sort of. I mean, sort. The very beginning.
At the very beginning.
Like on the first day. Like,
okay.
You know, no, really. I mean, there was when I started it, if I'm remembering the interview you're talking about, when I started the book, I didn't know what I was starting. And so I was writing about this other kid who got picked on a lot, actually, who was sort of in a lot of ways the opposite of this narrator. Mm-hmm. But it was very fast and kind of violent, and he was using a kind of language that I liked. And I definitely turned up the volume on the intelligence of that language as time went on, and Gurian, my narrator, is about as far from a victim as you can get, whereas this original kid kind of, you know, was. But.
Well, you know, writers talk about where characters come from and about how the voice sort of comes to them. Sometimes the way writers talk about it, they talk about it as if they're channeling the character and make it sound sort of mysterious. And
right.
I'm sure that in some way it is like that. But on the other hand, this has to be the origins of the character have to be in you somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. I mean, that would be absurd to suggest otherwise. I mean, but I think that it's more, and I can't speak for other writers, but for me, the voice ends up defining the character, like and the way that I write, I'm a very, very sentence to sentence writer. I'm really slow. I take a very, very long time to be satisfied with a sentence. I don't know that I've ever written a sentence that I've published that hasn't been changed at least, you know, two or three times, and often more like 30 or 40 times. And I think that there's some kind of energy in a language that creates the voice, and then that voice determines who the character is. And I mean, that sounds, you know, that maybe is a little less mystical. I don't know. I mean, when we start talking about energy and language, that sounds pretty, you know, goofy. But I think that really is, you know, you think of it maybe more as, if we think of the energy as stemming from humor, then, you know, there's certain ways you can just sort of turn sentences until they, you know, a regular utterance becomes kind of funny for its speed, maybe. Maybe it gets across some information quicker than it otherwise would have. And then you start going, I want a narrator who talks that fast, who can deliver this kind of humor. Who is the guy that delivers this? And,
yeah.
You know.
Was there some – can you point to some moment when there was something, some phrase, some words, something that you would say that's when Gurian really was born?
Well, there's a section in the book called The Story of Stories, which is almost like it's pretty long. It's like a little novella in the middle of the book that is mostly about Gurian's parents. And that is in a voice that is distinct from the rest of the book. And there are a few sections like that. Like but at the time, it was very distinct from the rest of the book. At the time, it was much more. it was more academic or something. It doesn't sound academic. It sounds basically more aged, and he is writing/speaking in much longer sentences than he formerly was, and reflecting on things in a more analytical way than he formerly was early in the text. And when I wrote that, I had this decision to make where I really liked it. And I said, you know, I might like this and it might not be for this book, or I got to figure out how this is for this book. And I decided that this was for the book. And I said, Gurien is this narrator that's able to do this. He's a 10-year-old boy that can write basically like, you know, presumably a 40 or 50-year-old Philip Roth. But I can't lose the other energy that's going with it, mm-hmm. in the other section. So I think at that point I figured this is who Gurien is, and I have to figure out how to make the rest of the book sort of get up to that level without losing it, whatever charm it already has. So, yeah.
This is a big book, and I didn't want to be that the very first thing I said. Maybe that was, in fact, the very first mm-hmm. thing I said, but it's something that you encounter, mm-hmm. not only if you see it, but if you read anything about it.
Sure.
It's something that has
mm-hmm.
to be noted, that it runs to over 1,000 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said to you, I remembered reading a review of the book back in the fall when the book came out, and that when the possibility of having you on the program mm-hmm. came up, I remember I thought to myself, oh yeah, that's the 1,000-page novel
sure,
guy.
Sure, sure.
So yeah, and yeah. I said to you, well, okay, how exactly do you feel about, you know, that's the first thing that people say?
Yeah.
They really don't know anything about you. They say,
yeah.
oh yeah, that's the 1,000-page yeah. novel guy.
Yeah.
I guess you can't really escape right up front people right. saying, well, this is a big book.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a 1,000-page novel. You know, there's I didn't, you know, I wasn't aiming for a 200-page novel, you know. So it was I think I'd rather have them saying this is the 1,000-page novel guy than them saying, who's that guy?
Yeah.
You know, so I guess, yeah, there's you know, I think when folks, maybe when they see the book, it's more, it doesn't even become about quantifying the page number so much as like how large the actual volume is. It's like, physically big.
Yeah. It's probably even bigger than your one volume collected works of William Shakespeare or whatever
sure,
kind
yeah.
of big book you want
yeah,
to pick.
Yeah.
yeah it,
but
it,
somehow
it
not that heavy. So magically it's, it's, they did some magic over
part of the magic of the book. Yeah.
yeah. yeah. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's if after someone reads the book, if they say, oh, that's that 1,000-page book, then I failed. But if before it, I mean, that's the sort of the most salient feature of it when you haven't read it, right?
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah. It's well, you do, and clearly I'm sure that you also didn't set out to write a 1,000-page book.
Absolutely not, no.
And I can understand, I can understand an author says, well, you know, this is the story that I wanted to tell, and that's right. what it took to tell the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what it is.
Absolutely.
And you can read it or not, but yeah. but that's what it is.
Yeah.
I do wonder, though, did you have a tough time finding somebody willing to publish a 1,000-page book?
The editor at McSweeney's, I sent it to him, and he made an offer 10 days later. He read it. He read it in 10 days, and like it was an amazing experience, actually. So I had zero trouble. I got really lucky, though. I had published stories with them before in the quarterly, and I knew I wanted to work with him. His name's Eli Horowitz, genius. And I was like, I want to work with this guy. And so I sent him the book, and he was really into it. And it was sort of like it was the perfect thing that could have happened. So yeah.
And he didn't suggest, or did he suggest making any changes or making any cuts?
Oh, we made
a lot
of changes. I mean, I revised it with him really steadily. I mean, you know, 40 to 60 hours a week for 18 months. So I turned it in. It was, I think, at this point, like I did the page count thing back and forth, like, you know, but I think overall I turned it in, cut 400 pages or 300 pages and then added 400 pages. You know, it was like,
yeah.
it was the stuff, and he was really cool to work with because he's such a story focused guy and such a plot focused guy. And he's great at it, and I want to be that guy too, you know. So I want the book to be, you know, a fast moving thing where, you know, events are, you know, stemming from other events, and things are getting more and more intense as the book goes on. So and he was into that too. So there were no cuts for the sake of cutting. There were cuts for the sake of making the story, you know, more fun.
And so overall, you worked on this for 9 years.
Yeah, nine years.
Right?
Yeah.
9 years. And I guess I also read that there was a point several years into the project where you had 600 pages or something,
mm-hmm.
and then you cut a bunch, and then you wrote a bunch more.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
this was an enormous undertaking.
Oh, yeah.
You wrote at some period. We were writing every day on this.
Oh, I've always written every day on this. Yeah, I don't think. I mean, I write every day anyway, but I was writing pretty steadily, about, you know, six to eight hours a day, say, for most of the 9 years. And with a couple of years in there, I really screwed my back up. And so I was writing standing up, and I wrote a little less during that time because it's very hard for me to write standing up. Mm-hmm. I think for anybody, it's kind of a pain. But yeah, no, I mean, there's no doubt it's that I can't imagine I'll ever end up working on something as hard as that. I mean, like, just in terms of hours put into it. I mean, it was an obscene amount of hours.
Well, I did like one comment that you made in something I read about when you work with young writers, you say, pay attention to your posture because you're going to be sitting in front of your word processor for a long period of time.
Yeah. They don't listen. It's really funny too, because it's the ones that are more likely to listen are the ones that don't need to as much. There's a, you know, and but yeah, no, I have a couple students. I'm like, man, these are going to be some, you know, blow your mind writers. And I'm watching them over a period of semesters just get more and more stooped, you know. Mm-hmm. Like they're hovering over their computers, and I'm just like, sit up, man, it's worth it.
That's right. Well, I'd like that, because I guess what it says is that writing, and maybe people can't believe this or don't believe this, but writing is actually hard work, and it's physical work. And you're like, okay, so it's not like you're out digging a ditch, but that doesn't mean that it's not somehow physically demanding.
Right. Well, I mean, in fairness, I mean, I'm not a super athletic guy. So I mean, like I don't know how physically demanding, like if you're mindful, I think that you won't screw yourself up that bad. It's basically like get up every 20 minutes and stretch and, you know, stuff like that. But it's certainly hard work. I think, and, you know, and with me, I was smoking about 2 to 4 packs of cigarettes a day and drinking lots and lots of coffee. So in that sense, it was, you know, physically terrible. But, you know.
So you've since though gotten that smoking thing under control?
I quit smoking like about 2 weeks after I did the final edits on the galleys. I was like, all right, now it's time. You're dying.
So much for art.
Yeah.
Our guest is Adam Levin. His novel is The Instructions. It's published by McSweeney's. Came out last fall, so you can certainly seek it out. He's here on the campus spending some time talking about writing. This is part of the Early Spring Literary Festival for 2011. It's sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English. And I do want to mention that he's going to be doing a reading, and this is the afternoon at 2 in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. So if you'd like to hear from him, you should stop by. And questions are welcome. And we have somebody here who want to bring into the conversation. Other folks, if you're listening, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think we have somebody here in Champaign. And I believe that's line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
I have several questions. I thought I came in a little late, so I don't know if you might have touched on these. First, there's the obvious play on names. Since the first prime minister of Israel was David Ben-Gurion, it sounds like you're playing with that. I don't know whether probably you knew this, and you probably work build something on that, but I'd be interested to hear if that is or isn't part of what you're working with there. Another issue is the whole Ethiopian Jewish community and their relationship. First, the fact that it's very much a communal society, and I wonder how you developed that, or whether you just happened to have his mother being Ethiopian and therefore black, etc., but not really develop that. Or if you developed the relation, those issues, both in terms of black-white in America and also black-white in terms of Jewish community. I'll listen to you talk about that on the air. Thank
you. All right. Thanks. Those are good questions. As far as Gurion's name goes, certainly Ben-Gurion comes to mind. The play, there's actually that piece that I mentioned, Story of Stories, actually is quite a bit about how Gurion got his name, so I kind of don't want to spoil anything there. But you know, as far as names go, if I don't know how familiar callers with you know, Torah, but I would guess a bit. And you know, you have his mother's name is Tamar, his father's name is Judah, his father's last name is Maccabee. So you know, there are these that's sort of what gets riffed on in the Story of Stories. As for his mother being Ethiopian, I did not focus much at all on Ethiopian-Israeli society. Her family history is actually I did that as lightly as I could so that I would not be sort of treading into territory that I was not super familiar with. And it does end up being a lot more about sort of racial identity in America versus maybe religious or ethnic identity in America. This black and white thing, as you said. So.
Okay. And just at this point, I guess I would feel like I'd want to mention that you have said a lot in talking about the book that while it's really loaded with Jewish history, culture, tradition, it's really steeped in that sure. you weren't thinking that you were writing this book primarily for a Jewish reader.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
I think what I read is you said, well, you were writing it for an American reader,
right,
and that other part is
sure.
sort of incidental.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, there was, I don't really see, well, I don't know, I shouldn't say that. Writers can do whatever they want. I have always wanted to be writing for really an English-speaking audience, and I would guess, but maybe that's not humble enough, and I have to say an American audience because maybe the Brits think really different from us, or so I don't really think so, or the Australians, I don't know. But yeah, it's for an American audience, and I think there's certainly a lot of issues about chosenness and Jewish identity that come up, but I think these are actually issues that sort of are really America-wide. I think we all are identifying in ways, even if it's just I am an all-American American, that carries all kinds of issues with it itself, and I think can be likened to Jewish identity issues.
Yeah, and that I think that this thing that we have of elevating the individual above everything, I think that maybe there's some way to connect that too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you going back to the idea that this is one of those stories about smart kids that don't fit in and again I don't want to give away too much about the book but about the hostage incident that ends up being the climax you sort of wonder do you really think that inside every teenage boy and maybe a few boys who are not teenagers anymore there is the seething mass killer just waiting to break out?
No. No, and I don't think that I wouldn't characterize Gordon.
You wouldn't characterize. Yeah. Oh, okay.
No, I mean I think he's first of all a 10-year-old. And that's like and that is something that he does a lot in his power to not remind you of as the book's going on. The book is written as though it is his scripture. That's his stance. But no, I don't think there's a seething mass killer inside of teenage boys. I think there is certainly a lot of aggression in kids and young men in America. I was certainly pretty aggressive. People I know were, and I don't think we were particularly strange in that.
And that's nothing particular that hasn't just happened like within the last 20 years.
I would think it's the opposite, actually. I mean, I think that in the last 20 years we've had these, we've had these school shootings that have been these, massive big deals in the media, and those are terrible. But I think those are really freak incidents. And I think that Gurion's kind of toughness or violence is actually more I am going to beat you up because you looked at me funny kind of thing. And it's more that, I think, than it is despite what happens at the end, without getting too into it. I mean, I think it's not we have these myths about what Columbine was about, for instance, and which I'm reading this book, Columbine, now, actually, which sort of dispel almost all.
Well, actually, and if it's a book I'm thinking of, I've talked to Dave Cullen.
It's pretty awesome so far.
Yeah, I think he spent so much time and immersed himself in that story in trying to understand the perspective of these boys that I think he almost lost it for a little while himself.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really interesting book.
Yeah.
And I think it's important because it tries to dig down below the surface accounts to try to understand, what really was this about?
Sure.
So anyway.
Yeah. No, and I mean, so I guess I would say that I think that, I think that people who are my age when they were kids are tougher. Or were tougher kids than those who are a bit younger, and I think I assume this goes back, this continues back, in that you got your father, you're the weaker version of your father. My son will be the weaker version. You know what I mean? I it seems like on a sort of interpersonal like small level, I really think that's how it seems. It seems like now there's so much you know, the way to bully someone now, it's so – you can really hurt a kid. Like, you know, you see the stuff in the media by doing things that when I was a kid would not be, I don't think, considered bullying. It's not that they weren't lousy. You know, call someone names, that's really lousy. But that's not so often going to lead to total heartbreak. You know, like it's going to be like, yeah, that person is a bully and a jerk, you know. But now it seems like – even the idea that someone doesn't like someone is really threatening to the egos of some kids today. Yeah. It really worries me a bit. But I don't think.
If that is in fact the case, why do you think that that has happened?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think mostly because I think we kind of want to believe in that people are nicer. I don't know. I have no good answer for that. I mean, I think about it quite a bit, and nothing ever comes up. I mean, that is, you know, examinable. But I mean, I suspect that it has something to do with our society being a little more afraid than it was when I was a kid, and, you know, and probably a lot more afraid than it was when, say, my father was a kid or my older cousins were kids, to the point where, you know, we have all these zero tolerance policies at school now. Like, there was no zero tolerance policy when I was at school. And so what's weird with a zero tolerance policy is that if you get expelled from school for punching someone in the nose, right? Mm-hmm. And you get expelled from school for shooting someone, or for bringing a gun to school, right? Then why not just bring the gun to school, right? Like, you know, you're going to be scarier with a gun. I that might have something to do with it. Like, I don't know. Yeah. But it just seems like there's a lot – the tolerance for violence is too low now, maybe. I don't know. I mean, that sounds really weird coming out of my mouth, I feel like. But there's a part of me that thinks there's a kind of boys will be boys thing, and that when that's not when kids aren't allowed their space to be a bit aggressive, then they'll push it down, and in most cases that'll be fine, but in some cases they'll pop up like a, you know.
Yeah. I haven't thought about this in a long time, but I guess I thought about the fact that when I was a kid and I was in grade school, when at least one of my buddies in their home there were guns.
Okay.
I mean,
yeah.
That was just, you know, they had guns and they shot and they hunted and, you know, that, and we thought, well, this is really cool.
Right.
The idea of bringing a gun to school, I don't think that ever occurred anybody.
Right. It doesn't, because, yeah, it would seem sort of maybe cowardly or just outlandish. I mean, seem, it's not something you'd think of doing, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, because maybe you dealt with stuff a little more with fists or something. Like, I don't know. Or not, you know, or that was the that was the available solution.
Yeah.
I don't know. But really, I'm not a sociologist. And, like, I'm sort of talking out of my throat. Like,
Well, our guest in this hour of Focus is Adam Levin. He's a writer, makes his home in Chicago. He teaches at Columbia College and also the School of the Art Institute, and is the author of the novel The Instructions. His first novel was published last fall by McSweeney's, and you can go look for the book. It's quite an interesting experience. He also has a collection of short stories, Hot Pink, that will be published by McSweeney's this year. And his work has also appeared in Ninth Letter, Tin House, McSweeney's, Esquire. And he is here on the campus as part of the Early Spring Literary Festival for 2011, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English. And we'll be giving a reading along with T.A. Noonan at 2 this afternoon in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. And I'm sure anybody who would like to stop by should feel welcome. And here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. On one level, I think The Instructions is this book about a 10-year-old boy who is trying to figure out who he is and what his place in the world is.
Sure.
And there is this messianic angle to it where the question is he or is he not the Messiah?
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, do you see the instructions in any way? And you talked earlier about Talmud. That's what Talmud means, mm-hmm. instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a lot, and as I said, about Jewish religious history tradition. So having said all that, do you think of this in some way as a religious book or as a book about religion?
Well, yeah. I mean, my narrator certainly does,
yeah.
It's really the way that the book is set up. It's from beginning to end. It is presented as though it is a scripture by this narrator, And I mean, I guess it certainly talks quite a bit about religion. I mean, he explores the minutiae of religion. I think there are kind of Gurian's angle is to, I mean, he wouldn't describe it this way, but I would, is to sort of deliberately, I don't want to say misread, you know, the Old Testament, but or the Torah, however you want to call it, but to interpret it in a way that suits him. And in interpreting it, I think he does so fairly convincingly. He's analytically pretty strong. He's not taking a lot of ridiculous leaps. He's taking quite a lot of demagogic leaps. But yeah. So in that sense, I think it's about religion. I think that religious leaders do that quite a lot. You know, but it's not. But again, it's not like I'm not really interested at this point in writing, let alone reading books that's, you know, satirize religion or something like that. That seems like an old project that's been done well enough. So yeah, I mean. Yes and no.
Good answer.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah,
there, your work has been, and I suppose this is inevitable. Someone comes along and they start to get attention, and they write the first novel. People are going to compare them to other writers.
Sure.
And one of the writers that you've been compared to is Philip Roth.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the commentary about the instructions has to do, or people who have read it and who are thinking about it, has to do with either how it either fits in or with modern Jewish American writing,
right.
And Roth would be, you know, one of the leading examples,
mm-hmm.
or how it reinvents that and, mm-hmm. and how it tries to be something new. And
sure.
So I wonder how you see that, and do you somehow see this, see yourself as being in some sort of continuity there, or whether there was maybe some conscious effort on your part to do something else, to take it to some different level.
Well, I mean, I certainly think, I mean, Philip Roth is a huge part in the book. I mean, I think that Philip Roth, the work of Philip Roth, and you know, just Jewish American fiction in general, the book is in conversation with Jewish American fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to, you know, again, like, just sort of clarify what that means. Like, I think of Roth, as I was describing before, I think my book is for Americans. I feel the same about Roth's work. I don't think, you know, his it's called Jewish American fiction maybe because Roth is Jewish or because his characters are Jewish, but it's not as though this is something that you come to as a non-Jew, Roth's work, and go, what's this about?
It's
amazing. It's American fiction. It's great,
yeah.
American fiction. He's our greatest living guy. And I think, you know, I certainly don't think he can be, you know, ignored, and my narrator is obsessed with him. Maybe I've lost track of the question,
it's something that you clearly must feel some connection to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
But that this was not, you wouldn't say that this would, well, how you see this project,
yeah.
the project that
yeah.
was the instructions
yeah.
fitting into that or,
yeah.
taking it to someplace else.
Well, I mean, again, I should say, you know, it's weird. It's the conversation gets goofy around this stuff because mostly, like, even a phrase like Jewish American fiction, right? This is like a marketing thing. You know what I mean? I'm not saying, you know, you're a lowly marketing man lately, but this is, I mean, we can't help it. This is how we're taught to think about stuff. But I think it's fairly artificial. Like, I doubt Roth sits down and says, I'm going to sit down and write another great work of Jewish American fiction. And I certainly don't sit down and say I'm going to write, you know, any kind of work of Jewish American fiction. Like I said, I think the book is, you know, indubitably in conversation with the work of Roth, and I think with a number of Jewish comedians for that matter. But it's in conversation with a lot of other books too.
And well, again, I want to come back to something we talked about earlier, that in the same way that you were talking about Roth, it's certainly the non-Jewish reader is not going to pick up the instructions and say, what's this about?
Right.
Who are these people? So I think in that sense that it is a very American
mm-hmm.
book, and a very moderner, I don't know, maybe it's postmodern mm-hmm. American book.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things are true. Well, what other, in addition to, say, being in conversation with Philip Roth,
mm-hmm.
what other books or what other writers do you think that it's in conversation with?
I think Elkin. You know, he's another Jewish American writer, but you know, Salinger. I think, you know, some of the work of George Saunders, the way he's morally engaged. Those are short stories rather than novels. David Foster Wallace, for sure. I read, you know, obsessively about as obsessively as I read Roth. And then I think, you know, with certain, you know, they're not authors, I guess, but certain, you know, comedians. I think Seinfeld, Woody Allen. I think these guys are they play a huge role in what we think of as Jewish identity, and certainly what we think of as just urban identity. So I mean, in that sense, yeah, I think, you know,
yeah.
Conversation with all. Yeah.
Well, particularly when you're thinking about somebody like David Foster Wallace, mm-hmm. you think about somebody who has really broken the conventions of fiction as they were known before, mm-hmm. and was doing something that seemed to be very different. So
sure.
then if you say, well, set aside the Jewish thing and mm-hmm. just look at the modern thing or right. the postmodern thing, are there some particular features mm-hmm. of that kind of writing mm-hmm. and things that you would point to in your writing that you would say, well, when I think of mm-hmm. modern fiction, this is what I think of. You know, what mm-hmm. what would you say with the hallmarks of that?
That's an interesting one. I'd have to think about it. See, these are questions I honestly don't think that much about too directly. Mm-hmm. You know, with Wallace, what always blew me away about him was how moving his work was. And while being really, really funny and mm-hmm. really, really smart, and that he is able to go into a sort of analytical or rhetorical mode seamlessly from a narrative mode, a Wallace sentence is just so dense. There's so many things happening in one given sentence, and it's not in the way that there are so many things happening in a Faulkner sentence, but in that, like, he will be breaking your heart, saying something really smart about the universe, and giving you like this full characterization between these M dashes in one sentence, and I don't know, yeah. that's sort of so I think of those features of his work. People a lot of times talk about sort of fragmentary nature of his stuff, but I think that's mostly Infinite Jest. I think a lot of his shorter pieces aren't so fragmentary. And I think my book is quite a bit more linear than Infinite Jest.
Yeah.
I love Infinite Jest. But I would say, you know, with him and similarly to George Saunders, I think both of these guys have they present these really dark universes wherein really funny things are happening, and characters, it's not that they have redemption, but they are human. Like we, I think as readers, we are implicated in anything that they do, because we go from having contempt for their actions to being in sympathy with their actions, to having contempt for them to being in sympathy with them, in this way that, you know, I think maybe all great writing does that. I mean, like Flannery O'Connor does that too. But I think that those are the two in, you know, the recent years who are doing that, you know, at least in,
yeah,
for me, the most.
Well, it seems to me too that there's something about a kind of writing that we're seeing now that is, rather than that, in addition to being a kind of a straightforward storytelling,
mm-hmm.
there's also a kind of a running commentary on the story that's being told as it is being told.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a little like hyperlinks, some people maybe are not exactly sure,
sure
whether
sure.
that's such a good thing,
but
reflective of our, you know, how it is we think and
sure.
and read and use media these
Absolutely.
days.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's like the legacy of metafiction, which I think, you know, most sort of straightforward metafiction is maybe not so thrilling to read. Some of it is quite great. I mean, you know, The Babysitter by Robert Coover, phenomenal. Balloon by Bartholomew, Lost in the Funhouse. You have these short stories that are kind of amazing. But the idea that the novel is going to be about the novel getting across, I actually think mm-hmm. that has been around for quite a long time. I think that maybe that's been around longer than any other aspect of the novel. It's just that in the 80s and 70s, it disappeared. And it's really mysterious to me. Like, again, I'm not a literature student. I studied psychology and I studied social work. And then I went and I got an MFA, you know. But to me, it seems to me like Don Quixote does everything that the most postmodern novels do, and that's pretty much our oldest novel, and that kind of everything that I've loved, at least, you know, has sort of that aspect of making it's talking about what it is while it's telling you the story, up until, you know, the 70s and 80s we get into like Raymond Carver and Tobias Wolff and these sort of minimalist. They get called minimalists, but they're, you know, and they get called realists, but they're, you know, a certain kind of realism, a certain kind of minimalism. Those cats don't do that. But that's like the one exception, I feel like. I don't know.
Well, I want to come back to something you just mentioned, because it was something that I want to ask you about at some point, and that is the fact that indeed when you did study psychology, mm-hmm. and you have this degree in social work, sure. from the University of Chicago, yeah. and then you went to Syracuse to study writing.
Yeah.
What interested you about the one, but then drew you to the other?
Well, I mean, I've been writing pretty religiously since I was about 17. Since I started college, I used to play music, and then I just one day I sort of flipped out, and I was like, someone was late to practice, and I was like, I don't want to rely on people to make stuff, And I'd always written a little bit, and then I was like, I'm gonna focus on writing, and so I'd always written. And I never wanted to get an MFA, and I never wanted to take English classes. I read like crazy since I was a kid. I didn't want to be told what to read. I still am sort of that way, sort of kind of authority problem. But at the same time, I wanted to write because I was writing all the time, and I wanted to help people because I thought I could be good at it. So what happened was as I was finishing college, I heard about MFA programs that actually paid you, right? They gave you stipends. Mm. And that was suddenly this revelation, because I was one of these guys that was like, you can't teach people how to write, which I totally disbelieve now. I think that's silly. But at the time, I thought that, and I thought, I would like to have 2 or 3 years to myself to write. But I wasn't that good. And I got into a couple places that were pretty good. And then I got into the University of Chicago for social work, which is, University of Chicago. It's very good. In Chicago, it's like your dad wants to, high five you, yeah. every day, So so it was and basically what happened was some I missed a form, and I lost I was going to be given a TA ship so I could go have this fellowship thing, go to this place, and it got buried. And so I could go pay for an MFA, or I could go to, University of Chicago, get a social work degree. So I did the latter, and this was the best thing that ever happened to me, because first off, I got to learn a bunch of stuff that I wouldn't have learned, got in a real sort of rigorous environment. But secondly, then I ended up applying to Syracuse, because the first time through, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just applying to any place that might have money or something. And second time through, I'd read George Saunders, and who teaches there, and I was like, he was one of my favorite writers, and I was like, I want to work with that guy. And then I got to. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's come back to how you first thought you can't teach people to write, and then thought that you
yeah.
can.
Yeah.
I guess I'm thinking, well, and yes and no. Mm-hmm. So talk about in what way you can teach people what they have to bring to the party in the first place.
What they have to bring to the party in the first place is huge amounts of dedication, right? I mean, mm-hmm. If we're going to say, if the ideal student is coming to you and they first of all read a lot. Secondly, they actually write a lot rather than just think about being a writer. But then thirdly, the ideal situation is they're interested in you as a teacher. I mean, there is some aspect to that. When I was working with George Saunders, all my teachers at Syracuse, really, I got to work with Mary Gateskill, Arthur Flowers. These are writers who whose work I was pretty amazed by, if not completely amazed by, and most cases the latter. And that opens a person up to listen, But really, on a sort of nuts and bolts level, you can help people edit more than you help them, and that's a large part of writing. You don't sit down and go, I think that you should write a story about your mom, and that's whatever. But you can definitely teach people how to make their sentences tighter and how to go toward the stuff that they're afraid of, because a lot of times young writers they have some idea that's really hot, and it is hot, and they put it off for as long as possible because they think that the story is going to disappear. There's not going to be a story if they go straight to it, And then they get to it and they dodge it because something complicated comes up. And there are these things you show people how to do that. And I think I've had students that it's the most thrilling thing to watch them, get better over a fairly short period of time. Yeah. So
about 5 minutes here with Adam Levin, and we have a caller in Urbana, so I want to make sure we get him. Line one, hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Does your central character say anything profound? I would think if he was portrayed as potentially messianic that he would have said something, at least several things profound, and if so, what? Can you cite offhand?
Well, I would say the first part's easier than the second. He certainly believes he says a lot of profound things. I don't think I could cite them offhand. I think they're probably all over the place. He's constantly making sort of very, if not incisive, then would be incisive commentary on the world, the universe, human being, a human being, etc.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to our last, maybe about 5 minutes or so. And one of the reasons that people read, one of the reasons that they read fiction, mm-hmm. is that it takes them out of their lives.
Sure.
And in some way, it stops time for a while. And I'm interested in this, also something that you're interested in and write about in the book is stopping time, mm-hmm. which is a thing that definitely creeps into the mm-hmm. story. And it makes me again go back to the we were talking about the length of the book and how everybody comments on the length of the book mm-hmm. and about how many things I have read where people have said that in one way or another it's the thing about I was caught up so much in the story I didn't realize it was that. Didn't feel sure, that long, sure. or yeah. you know, and I'm sure a lot of people have the experience of coming to an end of the book and saying, "Well, I wish that the story didn't
yeah.
end."
That's hugely flattering when I get that. Yeah. yeah.
Well, so here, I wonder whether you think that this is a really extreme example of the story is so big and so long, even though the story itself in the story we're talking about a few days, mm-hmm. whether that is in a sense a pretty extreme mm-hmm. Instance of stopping time or wanting to stop time for people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not so sure if it's as much about stopping time as it is like, I mean, I think the books I like, the books I love have all, I always get the sense that they were written to be fallen in love with. Uh-huh. And I think that when you make a book, when you make any work of art that is supposed to be fallen in love with, there are going to be a lot of people that can't fall in love with it, right? It's like a human being, right? But then the people who can, they just want to always be with it because they're in love. And so I mean, I think what I was going for was there are people who the book, clicks with. And yeah. The book definitely invites rereadings, as crazy as that might sound. And I've got people, who write to me who are, rereading it and rereading it again. And it's like it's intense, and I'm like, and I'm flattered by it. Like, and yeah, I don't, and yeah. I don't think it's weird. That's what I've done with all the books that I've loved. That's pretty much the biggest compliment you can pay me. So I'm not so sure if it's about stopping time, but there is, I think, like when that magic thing happens when you're reading, what it is that you feel like you're being spoken to, and you feel like you are being acknowledged as a thinker and a reader by the author, that you're on the same page, so to speak. Yeah. And I hope that's yeah. that happens.
Well, I think it's a kind of a book that demands that kind of engagement. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it can be read casually.
Right.
I don't think it's not that kind.
It
of
asks book. You. It asks you to be involved with it. Yeah. yeah. It's not. It's yeah. You don't read it in little.
I definitely don't want to be giving away stuff about the end, mm-hmm. I guess I would say that I suppose if you do read the book, there is a certain on one level there's a certain inevitability about mm-hmm. the ending.
Sure,
it would
sure.
seem, and yet at the same time, in this strange way, I think that the while the story does come to this somewhat inevitable conclusion, there is also a way in which the book ends by suggesting all possible endings mm-hmm. and none. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, when I looked at that, I guess I wasn't exactly sure how I felt about that, whether I felt that I liked that. And so what that does is it says to the reader, well, okay, you can choose. Mm-hmm. Or whether I would want to say to you as the writer, I say, well, that's a dodge. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you pick one for me?
Sure. Yeah, and I would say I certainly did pick one. Like I think that with the ending of the book, again, it's hard to talk about in an abstract way. But yeah. the book, builds plot wise, I think, very steadily, and then it becomes very intense. There is a huge climax,
right.
And then really, what you're talking about is in the denouement. And I think that in the denouement, though, there, it's not that every ending is a possibility. I think that there's a lot of mocking of sort of conspiracy theories going on, and there's really a couple endings that are possibilities. But again, when we talk of endings, that sounds like what was Rosebud really, and what Rosebud really was is done. Like that's taken care of. Like it's more like the narrator is now in this sort of psychological space that he's sort of embittered a little bit, and. And I think the ending is sort of very the things that are up in the air as to how he ended up where he was. I think mm-hmm. those are you're down to two or three feasible choices, and any which one of them. I think his line is it's all the same. It doesn't matter anyway. This is where I am now. This is what I want you to do, kind of thing. This is very vague sounding.
Yeah,
trying to talk about it without talking about it.
And I suppose that does get that this that whenever you come to the end of the story, I suppose even if it seems to be the end, mm-hmm. there's always the, well, there's this impulse to want to know, well, okay, that's the end, but what happens next?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure. And I think that's a good thing, right? I hope.
Well, if you're if you're engaged enough with the story and the characters,
yeah,
that gets back to this, well, feeling like, well, you'd rather not have the story end.
Right.
Because they're never really, well, unless the ending is, and then everybody gets hit by a truck and everybody dies.
Sure,
well,
sure,
okay,
sure, sure.
Well, that's
right,
the end.
Yeah, you want to be with the characters more.
Yeah.
Like, you get
yeah
to the end of, you know, yeah, whatever it is, anything that has a sort of charismatic narrator, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is always Catcher in the Rye, right? Super charismatic narrator. Like, I read that book, you know, 30 times. I mean, like, you know, you kind of want to hang out with Holden. At least
yeah
I did. You know, like,
yeah,
and so you go back to it. But at the same time, I wouldn't have that book go on for another sentence, you know, and for $1 million, I would just, you know, you just pick it up and reread it, you know, and it gets richer. So, yeah.
Well, we're going to have to stop at this point. But if you want to read the instructions, you certainly can. It's published by McSweeney's, came out last fall. You can find it in the bookstore. You can find it in the library. And I would say take a look at it. It's an interesting piece of writing. Our guest, Adam Levin, he teaches in Chicago, where he lives, teaches at Columbia College and School of the Art Institute. His work has appeared in a number of places, including The Ninth Letter. It's a little thing, has its origins here,
yes,
on
yes
the campus of the University of Illinois, a really interesting literary magazine.
Great magazine.
It's been around for a couple of years now, so that's something you might want to take a look at. McSweeney's, of course. And he's going to give a reading this afternoon at 2 o'clock. This is in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore on the campus, and that's there for anybody who wants to attend. He's here visiting to take part in the Early Spring Literary Festival for 2011. This is the second time that they've done this in the creative writing program at the English department. And hopefully we'll keep going on and we'll have some more folks in the future. And thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Appreciate it.